You mentioned the sound of the Hoopers. What you're listening to now is the honking sound of the Hooper Swan over County Wexford, if you don't mind. They are a winter visitor to the wetlands throughout Ireland from October to April and nest in Iceland during the summer months. But here's a rather startling figure. Hooper Swan populations grow, can you believe it? Wait for it, 30 times faster in nature reserves than they do in non-protected areas. Seems a bit obvious to me. Anyway, researchers looked at 30 years of data on Hooper Swans at 22 sites in the United Kingdom and found that population growth was so strong that many moved to non-protected sites. I wonder what impact that'll have here. Well, we're going to find out. We're going to speak now to Kendrew Colquhoun, an ecological consultant, and he joins us now from Malin Head in Donegal, where he's trying to catch barnacle geese, of all things. Kendrew, set the scene.
Well, I'm extremely lucky here to be overlooking Tobago Bay, having been watching the barnacle geese, which have been evading me for the last 3 days. I've watched them go out to the sea to roost. They go out to an island off on the mouth of the bay here. I can see Fannad Lighthouse and Torrey Lighthouse, and it's just beautiful.
Kendrew, for my money, the barnacle goose, I think, is one of our most attractive winter migrant visitors to Ireland. There's just something really very special about them. They're mainly black and grey coloured geese, but they have a black neck, but a lovely white face and a very dainty, dinky little beak that gives them a very cute look. And this is the species as well that historically in Ireland, particularly among monks during Lent and on Fridays, it was believed, or at least they pretended perhaps, that these were actually fish or seafood or sea creatures rather than birds, so they could actually eat their meat. The origin of the name barnacle goose is it was actually believed that the young geese were actually goose barnacles in the sea, and that the geese then would transform from the barnacles into adult geese in kind of the way that a caterpillar transforms into a butterfly and then would take flight so that people would eat them. Now, how much of that was wishful thinking and how much of it was genuinely believed, I don't know. But the barnacle goose was meat that was eaten on Fridays in Ireland and elsewhere as well. So quite a fascinating species and a good big place in Irish culture.
Did you ever taste barnacle geese, Richard Collins?
No, I did not, and I never tasted Brent geese. They are said to be rather fishy tasting, and people have said that to me, but I don't know if that is true. They are a beautiful bird, and being wanted, they may be more wondered at. They are the hardest of our geese to see. You have to make great efforts to go and see them, visiting islands and that sort of thing. But you appreciate it all the more when you see them. There used to be a fine flock at Lissadell. That was one main and flock. I don't know if that's still there, but it was very impressive to see them. Beautiful, beautiful birds.
Well, we're not really here to talk to Kendrew about barnacle geese today. We're going to talk to him about Hooper swans and this study that has proven they do better in protected areas than outside of protected areas. So, Kendrew, the conch is yours, as they say. Tell us more about this study which you are involved with.
Yes, I saw some lovely Hooper swans earlier on today, and they're on their way to Iceland. They'll leave very soon, in fact, and up in the northern part of the country as their last landfall before they'll make their journey now to Iceland. Any day, I would say, they'll start to go. The research published in the last week, the study that was published by the University of Exeter, the team that I was working with, led that piece of analysis, and it's based on really analysis of colour ringing data. Obviously requires you to catch a swan, put a colour ring on, like Richard would have done lots of times and mute swans. And then it requires lots of people to, not to catch those birds, but obviously to read the ring in the field. The database for Hooper swans is absolutely massive. It's probably hundreds of thousands of records over 30 years. And the analysis just done was analysing that over 30 years. The hypothesis was there any difference in various demographic parameters, survival, productivity and so on, between birds that wintered predominantly in protected areas and those that didn't. And of course, you only know what winters were by reading rings, and you need to do that for very, 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 very many years. And the protected sites are on in Great Britain, Kilaverock, Martinmuir and Welney. They're Wildfound Wetlands Trust reserves. And, of course, the wintering range for Hooper swans are all coming from Iceland. They're all over Ireland and Britain. And Ireland has, I think the last census a couple of years ago, had just shy of 20,000 birds. One of our success stories, the increase from the previous census was 27%. So in line with that short-term increase is our academic findings over the 30-year project, or analysis of 30 years of data, I should say. And that has shown that the protected sites, the reserves, are really almost like little factories. They are producing the birds there, whilst they're less, they have a lower probability of producing young. The adults have a lower probability of producing young, but they live longer. And the net effect of that, when you do the population modelling and the analysis, is that actually the net effect is that the population is increasing far higher on birds that are wintering in nature reserves than outside. I think the percentage difference is something like 0.2 or 0.3% population growth for birds that winter in the, you know, in the Shannon Valley and all parts of Ireland, for example, in the rural areas, versus the reserves, it's 6%. So that's a massive difference in the population growth rates depending on where you spend your winter holidays. And that is very interesting because, of course, protected sites, by their name, we want them to protect the birds there and we want them to help protect the populations. And actually, they're helping to sustain and indeed to grow the population in the wider wintering grounds and, of course, across the whole flyway by increasing survival rates across all age categories.
Sounds a bit obvious to me, though, to be honest with you, Kendrew. I'm no scientist, so I don't really understand the ins and outs of this. But if you go to an area that's protected, then you are, by the nature of the place, protected. So more of you will survive. Less predators get in there. Less harm caused by humans, etc.
Well, you know, we've got, I don't know how many special protection areas in Ireland, European SPAs, and I'm afraid they're not really delivering increases in bird populations. So I totally get your point, but this, what it seems like an obvious thing, is actually very, very seldom proven, because it's very difficult to, of course, disentangle. We expect protected sites to protect the birds and to help the populations, of course, but it's very difficult to understand the population-wide impact, and that's where this is so interesting. The population impact of, when you think about it, protecting one species at only a relatively small number of sites, and actually only for part of the year. The analogy might be, you know, lots of bird tables really being factories to produce increased populations in the countryside. But again, that's very difficult to have proved cause and effect. We found that survival rates were higher for all age classes on birds that were spent time in protected sites, but productivity, the probability was lower. But as I say, the net effect was that this massive growth difference, that is definitely driven by the protected sites. And the other thing that was happening is there is a kind of movement of birds, as I say, as almost a factory. The protected sites, there's a net movement over 30 years through time of birds from protected sites out. So it's almost like it's a factory. It's birds don't always stay in the protected sites, but the movement direction of birds is always from protected sites out rather than the other way around, which is partly why they kind of, their populations are increasing.
The swan who came in from the cold. Long time ago, when we arrived, the swans had a problem. What to do about us? Well, now, there was a great division among the swans between the mutes, the ones that I studied intensively, and things like whoopers. The mutes said, I think we'll make use of this crowd, people. We'll join them. We'll move into their habitat. We'll use them. We'll make a pact with them. And we'll do well out of that. But the whoopers' attitude was different. We must have nothing to do with people. They are a disaster. Stay away, out in the wild. So here we have a kind of watering down, have we, of that particular decision. The whoopers are saying now, well, we won't quite go into the cities and live next door to them, but we will avail of their protection. It's kind of partial reconciliation between us and the whooper swans. I wonder, is that a fair analysis or a fair observation about this?
I think so. You know, they're exploiting an opportunity, of course. Who wouldn't, when the dinner bell goes at 4 o'clock and you're getting fed and you're relatively safe at night, etc.? to know that that's having that sort of impact after, you know, decades of that is quite, it's actually quite a rare thing. You know, I know Derek was saying that, you know, protected sites should be protecting and therefore should be protecting populations. But actually, you look at how many times that protected sites, you can actually measure a population-wide impact on a species. It's actually pretty rare. And it's pretty rare to deduce what's going on and to be able to figure out what's going on, what is actually the mechanism behind all of that. And that is where the citizen science and the long-term commitment to that sort of work, it's the only way you can actually understand what's going on is through that sort of approach and that sort of long-term time series of data.
Kendrew, what exactly difficulty does a swan that leaves a protected area and goes to live in the wild, what extra problems does it encounter? What is likely to diminish its life or extinguish its life or prevent it breeding successfully vis-a-vis the ones that stay in the protected areas? What kind of factors are involved there, do you think?
There's obvious things like predation risk, I guess, you know, in a fenced, these reserves are fenced at night. And so whilst foxes won't take too many swans, for example, some will. So there's a definitely a lower predation risk. These birds, for example, will be much less prone to be flying around power lines. So, you know, they'll only be commuting between fields adjacent to the protected area, which is actually still protected because it's part of the reserve, typically, or fields and farmland immediately adjacent to it, vis-a-vis the birds down in the wider countryside, which are, as we know in Ireland, they're flying from Turlough, lake, river, or whatever to roost, to forage in fields, and they're flying across hedges and networks of low, medium and high voltage power lines. We know that in certain times, at certain times of year, that can be, there's significant mortality in particular places for that. The difference is actually something that we can't necessarily see, which is things like body condition from the food. So they're better prepared, therefore more likely to be productive. That's the kind of subtlety that there'd be a difference. But, you know, it's the survival rates, which was a really interesting thing. And as you say, it's, you know, what's the difference? Well, you know, it's those couple of factors, maybe, you know, not getting disturbed from farmmen by farmers who, you know, don't want the swans eating their grass. And, you know, then there's an impact on their energy budgets from getting constantly disturbed. And that has downstream effects on their productivity as well, perhaps.
Does it matter where you're born if you're a swan? Have you extended this to Iceland? The birds are breeding. Some of them are breeding in fairly safe, protected, not quite protected areas there, but others are in very remote areas. Does it matter in later life that you had a very good start, an affluent start?
Very good question. We haven't extended it to that. That's another thing to be explored, Richard. The problem is that lots of the birds that we ring in, or the Wildlife Witness Trust have been ringing in the reserves, you know, they typically catch 100 or 200 birds a year and put rings on their eggs. We actually don't know where they summer. So we don't actually know where they're breeding. Now, obviously, if we go to Iceland and catch birds, if they're breeders, we know where they breed and they're loyal to those sites. So the problem is that we would know the effect of breeding location only on those birds where we had caught in the breeding grounds or happened to recapture that were ringed in the wintertime in their breeding grounds. But the other way around, we don't know unless we catch them. So that would be a harder question to ask. I remember that there certainly is some sort of spatial arrangement. You know, easterly birds in eastern parts of Iceland are far more likely to winter in Britain, and birds in western Iceland are far more likely to winter in Ireland. That's been, you know, that's 10 or 20 year old science on that. But there hasn't been, to be honest with you, there hasn't been a lot of contemporary research done on hoopers. This has just been a piece of work that's based on a 30 year accumulated data set, but there really hasn't been much activity. The last Iceland based activity was maybe a decade ago or so. The steam has kind of run out of that. And it's great. Part of that is, of course, because they're being successful and they're one of, they're doing well, unlike many other birds, unfortunately.
I'd have thought that the great journey across the sea, this is the longest non-stop journey that any swan of any species makes, I think. Now, I remember hearing that at a conference on swans that the idea that they flew very high in the sky on migration, for instance, wasn't really the case. They actually very often fly just over the surface of the sea so that when fog comes or a gale or something, they can land in the sea. Has there been any that you mentioned the research that has stopped, but has there been anything on that since the research has stopped? Is there a choice between having to go high up, 12,000 feet was mentioned, I remember, and that's in memory, or flying just a few feet above the waves? Has anything happened there? Is there any suggestion that one of these techniques is better than the other?
I don't think there's been a massive amount of research on that since. Colin Pennyquick, who did that piece of research, has unfortunately passed away. He was a fairly elderly scientist at when he published that work. And of course, that was a fascinating story because that was inspired by I think air traffic control in Western Scotland or Northern Ireland told a pilot to go and look at what these objects were at you say 12,000 plus feet. And the guy went and he saw some swans. And it was October, and this was, you know, there certainly weren't mute swans at that altitude at that time of year off the north coast of Ireland. Could only have been hoopers. And that's what inspired Colin's work. And I think Colin, basically the conclusion there was, as you say, that lots of birds, it's more efficient and safer for them to fly at low altitude. But on certain occasions, the atmospheric conditions where it's efficient, these birds can fly at high altitude. We satellite tracked some more, and Wildfoot Wetlands Trust have tracked many more actually over the last few decades, and I don't know necessarily the outcome of all of that, but I strongly think that these birds were flying at low altitude, as you say, over the waves, ready to ditch if necessary to rest in bad conditions. I think that journey for them in spring and autumn migrations, again proven by satellite tracking, has been that the real risk there for them, which is why it pays to stay low, is whenever they encounter conditions that they can't predict. They're halfway across that 800 mile journey and there's a big front, and they get pushed really far east, and that's when it does. They can run out of steam really, and they ditch, and birds are undoubtedly lost on migration, both migrations due to stormy conditions.
Kendrew, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you again soon.
You're very welcome, everyone. Take care.